This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 125.
A core message of our book, Make Work Fair, is that this needs to be fairness, needs to be something that's embedded into the everyday things that we're already doing, and that we have to approach fairness exactly the same way, with the same seriousness, the same tools, as we approach the rest of our core business. And when we look at it through that lens, fairness is just one critical enabler, among others, of a high-performing organization, right? We need to hire the right people into the right roles. Then we need to give them the support and the tools to actually do their work in the best way. And one of those tools is flexibility, as we just discussed. And then we need to evaluate these people fairly so that we're able to progress the best people into the top jobs and channel everybody into the roles where they can most contribute.
How can we make work more fair? Why should fairness be embedded in all core HR processes? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Hey there, I'm excited to announce an amazing resource for next-gen HR leaders that has been 2 years in the making. After conducting over 100 interviews over the last 2 years with the top minds in our field, I have put all the best advice into what I call the HR Leaders Blueprint, career acceleration strategies from 100-plus industry thought leaders. The HR Leaders Blueprint is completely free and filled with 18 pages of real-world advice from over 100 HR thought leaders. This guide delivers exactly what you need to know about building influence, driving business results, and accelerating your HR career. And just like the Future of HR Podcast, the HR Leaders Blueprint is filled with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to help take your career and impact to the next level. To download the HR Leaders Blueprint, go to futureofhr.com. That's futureofhr.com. And the best part is that after you download the HR Leaders Blueprint, you'll also be subscribed to the Future of HR newsletter, which means you'll be joining an exclusive community of next-gen HR leaders who want to accelerate their career and elevate their business impact. And the Future of HR newsletter is the only newsletter written for next-gen HR leaders like you. Think of it as your weekly HR leadership booster shot, quick, powerful, and designed to help you put the ideas into practice immediately. So what are you waiting for? Go to futureofhr.com and download the HR Leaders Blueprint and get a jump start on your 2025 career goals today. And with that, my guest this week is Siri Shalazi. Siri is a senior researcher at the Women in Public Policy program at Harvard Kennedy School and an internationally recognized expert in advancing women and promoting gender equity in organizations. As an academic researcher, Siri specializes in identifying practical approaches to close gender gaps at work by de-biasing structures and designing fair processes. Siri has just written a new book with her co-author, Iris Bonnet, called Make Work Fair, Data-Driven Design for Real Results. And as I read Make Work Fair, what stood out to me was the fact that this book is based on research, and they highlighted evidence-based methods that were tested in many organizations and proven to work in the real world. I highly recommend you pick it up if you're looking to evaluate your current HR practices or looking for a blueprint on how to embed fairness into your HR processes. I really enjoyed my conversation with Siri as we discussed why fairness in the workplace creates better outcomes for both the organization and the individual, why it's more effective to focus on changing behaviors and systems rather than attempts to de-bias people, why fairness is a collective responsibility, not just for HR professionals, the importance of fairness and how it should be embedded in every core HR process, and why transparency is a key enabler of ensuring fairness in the workplace, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn or say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Siri. Siri, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
Thank you so much, JP. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here with you.
Oh, I'm really excited to have you here. You've got a fantastic new book called Make Work Fair, and I'm super excited to dive into fairness and all the research you have there. But I really wanted to start off about and understand more about you and your co-author. So you set out to really write a book that's really evidence-based and actionable. But tell us about more about why you decided to write Make Work Fair.
Iris and I are both academic researchers, behavioral scientists, and we study gender equity at work, but more broadly, how we can make workplaces more fair, less biased, and just frankly, better and smarter for everybody. So we've been doing this research for years already, sharing it with practitioners through talks and workshops and trainings. And we've discovered that there's often a disconnect between the wonderful insights and knowledge that are being generated by researchers and academics like us and the things that are happening on the ground. So one of the main reasons why we wrote this book is really to serve as an actionable roadmap for HR professionals, certainly, but also, frankly, people in all roles at all levels of organizations to help make their own work more fair, and in so doing, help make their organizations collectively more fair. There's a lot of information out there if you Google fairness, how to hire, what's the best way to conduct an interview, how to improve recruitment. You'll get a lot of hits online. Most of that information is not based on evidence, based on research, or proven to actually work. One of the biggest challenges I see sometimes, not just in HR, but frankly in organizational practices, just more generally, is there's a lot of copy-pasting going on. People look to some of the biggest companies like Google and Apple. What are they doing? They're doing unconscious bias training. Well, I guess we should do unconscious bias training as well. It makes total sense as a natural impulse, but this is one of those cases, specifically with unconscious bias training, where it's actually been studied for 5 or 6 decades, and it hasn't really been shown to lead to behavior change, which I think is, at the end of the day, what we're all after. So we are looking to bring the actual knowledge and insights about what truly works and what doesn't to make progress on creating fairer workplaces.
It's so important because a lot of times, if you're not an academic, you don't read all of the academic journals, or it's hard to translate, hey, what does this mean? So what you're doing is a real service.
Well, thank you.
Help us understand that.
And frankly, I wouldn't expect anybody other than academics to read these academic papers. They're often 70, 80, 90 pages long, full of jargon, full of super crazy statistics and math. They're frankly not designed to be accessible to other people, which is a whole other conversation and challenge. But I think one of the places we as academics can do a better job and need to do a better job if we want our work to make a difference in the world is helping to translate, distill the core insights from the research that we're doing, and then actually go out there into the world and come have this chat with you today, JP, like we're doing, and help spread the word about what folks should be doing in organizations.
And one of the stories, Siri, that really just resonated with me, it's this fascinating example of how Astrid Linder revolutionized car safety testing. And I'm like, I had no idea that car safety testing needed to be revolutionized, but maybe you can share a little more about the story and how it relates to making work fair.
Yeah, you know, I had no idea either until I came across Astrid Linder. She is a Swedish engineer who serves as the research director of the Swedish National Road and Transport Research Institute. And the way she describes her job is saying that her job is to make car occupants more safe when people are on the roads. Astrid and her team a decade ago discovered that there is actually no crash test dummy out there, or at the time there was no crash test dummy out there on the market that was modeled on an average female's body. It turns out that biological females and biological males, women and men, have some important differences in things like bone density, mass distribution, body mass as a whole. And those differences turn out to matter quite significantly in car crashes. Around the world, women on average drive less than men, but they are more likely to be injured in car crashes, especially in rear impact crashes. There's research on this around the world, including here in my home state of Massachusetts. So Astrid Linder and her team set out to develop the world's first female crash test dummy that back then didn't exist. Fortunately, now more and more are coming out. And here in the U.S. also, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has recently issued a new plan to both develop more female crash test dummies, but make sure that they're actually integrated into safety testing. But the reason Iris and I shared this example at the outset of our book is because we think it's such a beautiful example of how you can make work fair by making small changes to the things that you are already doing. Astrid Linder was already running crash safety tests in Sweden and directing how they would happen. So she just said, how can I make those tests better? How can I include more people in them? How can I make sure that every single person, regardless of their gender, shape, size, you know, there's big differences in body sizes, heights, shapes, some people are pregnant, so on and so forth. So there's a lot further that we have to go to make sure that truly all people are safer in cars. But that's what she was able to do in her own work. And we hope that our book will help everybody, regardless of role or seniority, whether you work in a blue-collar occupation, whether you work in retail, frontline, whatever your job, that we can offer you some ideas for how to make your own work more fair.
It's a great story and so inspiring, right? To think about how can you take what you're doing today and make more fair for everybody. And that's what we do in HR. So we've got to think about that every day. So thanks for sharing that story. It really grabbed me. And you also in the book talk about six key myths that we need to debunk around fairness. We can't go through all six, but I'd love to know of the six, what do you think are most important for HR leaders to understand and help debunk in their organizations?
Let me highlight three. You know, there's that famous rule of three. The first is the myth that in order to make progress on fairness or get people to behave differently, that we need to de-bias individuals. The logic goes, if we want people to, let's say, hire with less bias, we need to first take the bias out of their brain so that they can make more objective and better hiring decisions. Well, it turns out that's not what the science suggests. There's actually no evidence to suggest that we can de-bias humans. Bias is a facet or a fact of how human brains process information. It's the shortcuts and heuristics and patterns that we rely on to process information every single second. And there's no evidence to suggest that we can reprogram human brains to take this bias out. But the good news is, there's a lot of evidence to show that by changing the systems and the processes or even the physical environments that we surround ourselves with, we can still make better decisions. So let me give you a very simple example. When we're conducting interviews, oftentimes we conduct these unstructured interviews where we walk in, we have the person's resume in hand, we say, oh, well, I see that you went to such and such school. And oh, I see that your hobby is also Zumba dancing like mine. Oh, how great. And then you just start talking about random things that have nothing to do with the competencies required for the role and direct us to focus on things like similarity. Do I like this person? Do I think they would be a fit with my team? Or do I just think that it would be fun to go on a business trip with them? Again, nothing to do with necessarily the competencies required for the role. So without changing people's underlying biases, we can simply shift that hiring process by moving to a more structured interview format where we select the questions that we're going to ask in advance, and then we ask all candidates for a given role the same set of questions in the same order so that we can compare their answers in an apples-to-apples fashion because we've actually covered the same topics with all of the candidates that we met with. So that's an example of a very small, and I would argue costless, really, process change that does nothing to try to de-bias the individuals, but helps us demonstrably, as evidenced by research, to be much more objective and fair in how we evaluate those candidates that we've met with.
Yeah, it's a great example. And I think we all know structured interview are. The problem is most organizations don't take the time to be intentional about doing that or developing it. Or we allow managers to do those ad hoc interviews where they say, hey, I really like you, or we go a different direction. And I think that is really key. The two pieces you just mentioned are most critical. What are you hiring for? What are the criteria? And how do they stack up against other candidates is where you're going. So I think that's a great example.
Yeah. And the time constraints are real. I hear this a lot from people as, oh, it takes so long to update job descriptions. It takes so long to really write out the criteria. I'm not going to argue with that. It definitely takes a long time. The only thing I will say is think about your business, right? Think about where you spend your time. You prioritize according to what you think is most critical for the business. So if you actually think that hiring the best people is critical, putting the right people in the right role so that they stay longer and do a better job for you, then this is time well spent. This is simply something that must be prioritized.
Hey, everyone. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Siri. Are you ready to take your career to the next level? If you are, then you need to download the HR Leaders Blueprint, featuring battle-tested strategies from over 100 HR thought leaders and CHROs. This comprehensive 18-page guide delivers actionable steps, strategic frameworks, and real-world insights to elevate your impact. No theoretical fluff, just proven tactics to becoming a business-focused HR leader. And the best part, it's completely free. To download the HR Leaders Blueprint, go to futureofhr.com. That's futureofhr.com. And if you want to get a jumpstart on your 2025 career goals, then you do not want to miss out on the HR Leaders Blueprint.
I think you've also said in the book that we talked about this idea, of course, people will always be biased. As you mentioned, we can't de-bias people because that's just human nature, but we need to focus more on behaviors, not attitudes. What other behaviors should we be thinking about to achieve fairness in your perspective? How do we start to put this sort of systems and processes that drive these fairness behaviors in organizations?
That was actually the second myth that I was going to mention. So thank you, JP. And that's the idea that making progress on fairness is the responsibility of experts alone. So HR professionals, maybe if you have a chief diversity officer or a DEI team, that somehow a handful of those types of experts can, quote unquote, fix fairness for an organization of hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of employees. And I like to draw the analogy to communication skills. Most companies have some communications or PR professionals who maybe write press releases and the CEO's most high-profile speeches, right? But at the same time, every single person in the organization is talking to colleagues and customers, writing emails, speaking up in meetings, maybe creating PowerPoint presentations on a daily basis. So everyone needs to have at least a base level of communication skills in order for the organization to function. And it's exactly the same with fairness. So to your question about what are the behaviors, well, it's the behaviors that you are already doing. Most people are either running meetings or sitting in meetings. We need to tackle how to run those meetings, whether they're one-on-one or in group settings, better, so that we're actually able to benefit from everybody's wisdom, make sure that all the relevant perspectives get surfaced in those conversations, and that we leave people with a sense that they've been heard, even if their suggestions aren't always followed. Because we know that when people feel disrespected and overlooked over time, that's when they get disengaged, that's when they leave, that's when we lose out on their contributions. All the processes that are happening day in and day out in the organization, again, hiring, yes, but performance evaluation, promotions, figuring out who gets assigned to which project, or if there's a new task that should be done, who should do that task, and dividing up the so-called promotable or glamour work in the organization, those tasks that people will actually get rewarded and promoted for, versus the so-called office housework, like booking meeting rooms, sending out invites, taking the meeting notes, writing the birthday card, ordering the birthday cake for the colleague. These are things that need to be done, are nice to do, but let's be honest, most people don't get promoted based on doing those things. So the glamour work and the office housework needs to be distributed in a fair fashion so that some people aren't tasked with doing more than their fair share. Those are the types of everyday behaviors that we need to be tackling.
Great. And what's the third myth?
The third that I wanted to share is this idea that your gain is my loss, or that life or the workplace is a zero-sum game. Now, listen, I'm not trying to say that there's never zero-sum situations, right? We just recently had an election here in the U.S. There's a fixed number of spots in the U.S. Senate, and we elect exactly 100 senators. So in every race, there's a winner and a loser. But in most of our everyday situations in the workplace, there's actually room to expand the pie so that it doesn't have to be you or me, but it can be you and me. The story that I'd love to share related to this is what happened when the Americans with Disabilities Act was instituted in 1991. It was initially intended to help people with physical disabilities, such as folks who need to use wheelchairs, to participate more fully in everyday life. So we need to have elevators in addition to stairs. At the end of a walkway or a sidewalk, in order to cross the road, the curb needs to be smoothly cut so that you can easily roll down with a wheelchair. There aren't that many wheelchair users in the U.S., although now the number of Americans that have some kind of physical mobility impairment is actually up to 14 million. But how many people have ever pushed a stroller? How many people have ever taken public transportation with a bike or with a suitcase coming home from the airport? How many of us have ever temporarily had our leg or an arm in a cast where we also benefit from having the ability to take an elevator instead of the stairs, right? When you think about it that way, this process change, this design change that was initially inspired by people with disabilities that are a smaller group of the population, actually ended up benefiting everybody because it made our physical environments more accessible and more easy to navigate for all of us. And so I think the same exact principle applies to how we design our organizations. When we make them smarter, when we make them more objective and more fair, we're actually just making the workplace better for every single one of us.
It's a great example and something people don't really think about very often and how we've all benefited from that. So I'm really appreciate you bringing that up. I guess to play a little bit devil's advocate with
Go for it.
I could see some people saying, well, I understand this idea of abundance and we can really expand the playing field, but how does fairness really align up with meritocracy? People say, well, we can't promote everybody, right? We only have so many roles. We don't, you know, have so much money to give out and differentiate in terms of compensation or equity or bonus, right? So how does that line up with fairness?
I love that you brought up the concept of meritocracy. I'm so eager to talk about this. Let me paint a picture for you. Let's imagine that we have two sprinters who are equally fast, and they're about to run the 100-meter dash. JP, which one's going to finish first if they're equally fast?
Neither of them.
This is not a trick question. You're right. Absolutely. They're going to finish at the same time. But now let's imagine that the start line for one of those sprinters is moved back 20 meters so that they actually have to run 120 meters instead of 100. Not a trick question again, which one of these two sprinters is going to finish first?
The one that doesn't have the disadvantage was not 20 yards back.
Exactly. And this is the situation that we face today in our workplaces, is not everyone is actually getting the same equal opportunity to succeed, to show what they're capable of. Some people's start lines are further back compared to others. So the way I describe this work of fairness, the way I like to think about it, is that it's making sure that everyone gets to start at the same starting line. And to your point, in the real world, not all the sprinters are equally as fast. There's always one person who finishes first at the Olympics, right? And we know this in our organizations too. Not everyone has the capacity or the skills to become a senior leader, and not everyone wants to either. But what I think we should be able to do, and I know we can if we want to, is give everyone an equal shot at succeeding to their full potential.
Great example and really helpful. And I think it's a really great metaphor for thinking about when organizations design not as fair processes, or people have, to your point, are starting 20 yards behind the line.
Exactly.
And another concept that resonated in the book, you talked about that we need to treat people differently to truly treat everyone the same. Help us unpack this seemingly conflicting idea of treating people differently to treat everyone the same.
So I'll go back again to the racetrack and to this idea of the two starting lines, right? Is currently the evidence is very clear that certain groups of people face more hurdles in the workplace than others. Certain people's starting lines are further back. The pay gap is an easy example. Today in the United States, it stands at about 16%. So women on average earn 84 cents to the dollar that a man earns. There are many other examples around how, for example, women and people of color are disadvantaged in hiring, performance evaluations, project allocation, and so forth. So if I move one person's starting line 20 meters forward, you could look at that and say, oh my gosh, why are we only moving those people? This is totally unfair. But if you zoom out and you see that they started 20 meters behind, and all we've done is actually brought them to the same starting line as everyone else, now you might say, well, actually, that is the work of fairness, because now everyone gets to start on the same starting line and they have the same race to run. Another example of this in organizations could be the informal support that people receive, especially when they're new to the organization. if you started a new job and you, through connections, through school, through family, however, know a lot of people in that company who are willing to introduce you to senior leaders, give you the scoop on how things really work around here, you know, the informal, unwritten rules of how to get ahead, you're going to be at a significant advantage compared to someone who was hired through the formal process, who doesn't know anyone in the organization, and just walks in the door on day one, reads the employee manual, and starts to put their head down and do their best work. That's one example of how organizations can help to level the playing field by making some of these informal rules of success more explicit for everyone, so that regardless of who you know on day one, you have the same shot at showing your best talents. Because maybe the person who knew nobody on day one is actually the person with the most capability and skills who should rise to the top. You just never know. But we got to give them an equal shot to find out.
Yeah, it's really always difficult to potentially change a leader's mind on some of these topics. But these analogies and metaphors are helpful for people to say, well, let's talk about this in this way. And think about the sprinters, or to your point, someone joins and they know somebody already and they're now getting introduced. Like you said, that is an advantage. They've got immediately have social capital that's being leveraged versus someone else come in, maybe doesn't know anyone. So I think that's just a great example. And so we talked about the idea that the current hiring process is pretty broken, right? There's broken in different areas. We talked a little bit about how we might think about the selection and interview process and changing that. But are there other areas or actions you think we need to take around that? Because hiring is so critical, right? If we're not making the hiring process fair, you know, we are already starting 20 yards behind the starting line, if you will, for an organization, frankly, because we're missing out on great talent.
Exactly. And I think that's, again, going back to why are we doing all of this work? Well, we need, for our own success, to run the best companies to get the best business results, we need the right people doing the right role at the right time for the organization to succeed. Transparency is a magical force that research has shown to be very powerful in a lot of settings, including in hiring. It can really help organizations make the best matches and find the right people. So I'm talking about transparency, for example, in job advertisements around things like which aspects of the job can be negotiated. Can pay be negotiated? Can location be negotiated? Can, whether you're working 100%, 80%, 60%, can something like that be negotiated? That has been shown when an organization is explicit about what people can negotiate and not, has been shown to close the gender gap in negotiation and hiring. Similarly, when companies advertise jobs and actually make more jobs flexible, meaning that there's some flexibility around the location, the hours, which days you work, whether you work from home or from the office, they just get more applications from better talent across the board.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. I'm going to talk to you about really this idea of return to office, remote work, hybrid work. Obviously, another hot topic that's getting a lot of headlines recently. Mm-hmm. And the research I have read, to your point, is that remote work opens up a much wider talent pool, a wider talent pool than we'd all expect. And typically, that's a good thing for organizations. I think remote jobs get more applications than jobs that aren't remote, yet we're going the other way. So tell us a little more about why you believe we should be normalizing remote work and how it can support fairness.
Yeah, this is one of those interesting situations, real world situations, where the data is not 100% clean cut. There is a lot of evidence from studies around the world to suggest that when people have more flexibility in when and how they work, their productivity increases, their job satisfaction increases, and they are likely to stay longer. So these are all wonderfully positive things. There is also evidence to show that experiences for employees and managers sometimes diverge. Employees tend to be more positive about remote work, and managers sometimes are a little bit less so. And my guess there is that managers are used to managing people in person. They know how to do it when they have butts in seats and faces in front of computers that they can physically observe. And we haven't necessarily done a great job of helping managers and equipping them to manage a more remote or flexible workforce that's sometimes here, sometimes not, and often geographically distributed. The other thing we've discovered in research about remote work is that it can have detrimental effects, especially for younger employees, because when the older or rather more senior employees are not co-located with them, they miss out on some of those daily on-the-job learning opportunities that they don't now get when they can't walk over to the senior person's cubicle and say, hey, how would you exactly do this thing? So overall, the data does suggest that remote work increases productivity, but that does come with some caveats. And so I think the key here is to find ways to design solutions that are not one size fits all in these big companies with, again, hundreds of thousands of employees, but actually trusting people to do the work that we've hired them to do and allowing them to be the judge of how best to do it, probably within some constraints. I've seen companies institute, you know, 1, 2, 3 days a week that are days designated for joint work and brainstorming, and then designated focus days that are outside of that. Dropbox, when it moved to an all virtual model, designated a few days each quarter for people to come together physically and do intensive brainstorming and collaborative work. So there's not one model that works or another one that doesn't. Everyone has to find their own.
Yeah, thank you. Really helpful to hear more about the research. I think it's a debate that'll go on for a long time because I'm not sure everyone making the decisions is looking at the research.
Yes.
And there are trade-offs, which makes it a less than ideal situation. But the key there is the flexibility. I think giving people flexibility can also help with fairness as well and allow people to figure out how they do their work best and when. And I think that's really important. The other thing I was going to ask you, Siri, in recent months, we've seen companies even recently, really distancing themselves or retracting their earlier stances on diversity, equity, and inclusion, the commitments in their programs around that. And so I wonder what advice you have for HR leaders, organizations maybe contemplating similar actions, but really want to have the spirit of fairness and an inclusive culture of belonging, but maybe are backing down on different quotas or targets for diverse representation in their organizations.
A core message of our book, Make Work Fair, is that this needs to be fairness, needs to be something that's embedded into the everyday things that we're already doing, and that we have to approach fairness exactly the same way, with the same seriousness, the same tools, as we approach the rest of our core business. And when we look at it through that lens, fairness is just one critical enabler, among others, of a high-performing organization, right? We need to hire the right people into the right roles. Then we need to give them the support and the tools to actually do their work in the best way. And one of those tools is flexibility, as we just discussed. And then we need to evaluate these people fairly so that we're able to progress the best people into the top jobs and channel everybody into the roles where they can most contribute. When you put it this way, it sounds pretty mainstream, right? I mean, that's literally what we are all doing every day in our organization. So I think the way to get around all of this backlash and frankly to depoliticize the issue, because in my opinion, it should have never been political in the first place. This is just quite simply about managing our organizations, running them in the best, most objective ways that we can. One of the challenges I think that happened with the DEI movement, right, in the last 5 years or so, is it became very programmatic in nature. There were a lot of trainings, there were a lot of special speaker events, meetings, groups, ERGs, things that are separate from the day-to-day flow of work. So that when there's a political shift or a market downturn, budgets get cut, your quote-unquote real work overwhelms your calendar, it's very easy to skip the meeting, the event, the training module, because you have to focus on your important everyday work. That's why we need to embed fairness into that everyday work so that you're doing what you're already doing, not putting extra stuff on your plate, just doing it better.
Yeah, it's so well said. And the organizations that I have worked with and seen do this well, it has been building fairness, equity, and inclusion into their processes, right? From hiring, promotions, development, to your point. And I think they're moving away from some of the programmatic. And I think that's a really good insight. It makes it less visible and more invisible, but more impactful.
Yes. I think that point about invisibility is so important because sometimes organizations gravitate towards those splashy, one-off, check-the-box type activities that are easy to point to and say, look, We organized that International Women's Day event. Look, we celebrated Latinx Heritage Month or whatever it is. But actually, don't most people just want to get paid fairly, get fair consideration for promotions, get equal access to the high-profile projects or the type of work that they really want to do? I think, and yes, in some ways, that kind of structural stuff is sometimes more invisible in the background, but I think that's what makes up the majority of people's everyday feelings about their job. If you ask people, are you satisfied here? Do you want to stay here? Do you feel like you have an opportunity to grow? Do you expect to have fair consideration for advancement here? They're going to answer that based on how they get treated in meetings every day, how their manager, what their manager's tone is when they email them, right? Not on, oh yeah, I went to that one event.
Yeah. And I think what you're talking about, in my, the way I think about this is you're focusing on value drivers. These are everyday human needs that people want at work, not shiny objects and flashy new programs that maybe feel good in the moment, but actually don't have impact long-term. But yeah, there are probably some HR leaders out there who want to start to evaluate their organizations based on the concepts outlined in the book. Where should they start?
Well, you mentioned the magic word that I just love a few seconds ago, impact. And then the other one, evaluation. I'm a researcher, so I am a sucker for data and for experimentation. And I truly believe that data is our North Star. We must measure our efforts to see what's working and what doesn't, both so that we can make sure that we don't spend money and time and effort and goodwill on things that are actually detrimental, but also so that we can channel those important and limited resources to the things that can get us furthest, fastest. And the good news is we're already doing this in our organizations, but not so often in HR. I mean, think about A/B testing when we're launching new products or testing a new design for a web page or an e-commerce site. Or maybe we're testing the messaging for an email that's going to go out to consumers. We're used to already testing multiple different versions of the page or the message to see which best resonates. So all we need to do is bring this spirit of testing and experimentation into our internal processes, the way we run meetings, the processes we use to hire, evaluate performance, promote people, even policies around remote work, around parental leave, around expenses. If we're contemplating a new policy, why don't we roll it out to a small portion of the firm as a pilot experiment and then see, test what happens in that pilot group versus under our old process before we just shift wholesale to a new thing for the whole company?
Last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I am going to say experimentation. I think we've already been talking about data and analytics for a long time. There's people who know much more about AI than I do who are talking about that. And that's obviously a big feature too of the future of the workplace. But how are we going to make sure that we do it well and that we maximize the upsides of all of these things, data, analytics, AI, and all the other things that are to come, and minimize the downsides? Well, the only way is through experimentation, to actually test what we're doing and then double down on the things that work and drop the things that do not.
Awesome. Experimentation and making work fair. Siri, thanks so much for being on the Future of HR podcast. It was a great conversation.
It was such a pleasure, JP. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Siri for sharing her insights from her new book, Make Work Fair. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe or share our podcast with at least one other person, as this helps us to really grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Monique Herrera, who is the Chief Colleague Experience Officer of American Express, a position she's held since 2019. And under Monique's leadership, American Express has been named one of the top 10 companies to work for in Fortune's Great Place to Work in the U.S. for 5 consecutive years. This is a great conversation with a great leader and a great organization, and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.